It is a state capitol report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore legislation that would establish a state palliative care council providing guidance to the state health department on issues related to Wisconsinites seeking care for life-threatening illnesses. The World Health Organization cites tens of millions of people are in need of this care to improve quality of life. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Lynn Sexton is president and CEO of GRACE, that is a nonprofit healthcare agency providing hospice and supportive care in southern Wisconsin, and board chair of the Wisconsin Hospice and Palliative Care Association. Lynn, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. So the state assembly passes this bill that would establish a state palliative care council. Why do you support creating such a council?
In our state, we see an inadequate amount of access to this type of care, not only in hospital settings, but even more so, there's insufficient access when someone is in their own home and they need another set of eyes and ears helping guide them to relieve symptoms like pain and the stress of serious illness.
How does hospice care differ from palliative care? What is the distinction?
Yeah, great question. Lots of people are confused with that one. So hospice is meant for someone who has a prognosis of less than 6 months to live. Two doctors have to agree that that's someone's prognosis. Palliative care, however, is available to anyone at any time in their serious illness. It's meant for someone that specializes in palliative medicine. They work alongside your regular doctor, whether that's a primary care physician or some other specialist like an oncologist. A palliative care specialist works alongside those regular doctors of yours to really get at the heart of what are making your symptoms so awful and how can we improve your quality of life while you still chase after curative treatment.
So if a patient is asking for palliative care, it doesn't mean that they're not giving up on a cure or on life prolonging treatment. It's not like a choice like that.
Correct. Absolutely correct. Where hospice, by and large, is a choice, palliative care is not. You are still seeking curative treatment, but you have a set of symptoms that are really difficult for your regular doctor to get under control. And that's when your doctor could bring in a palliative care specialist to really help alleviate shortness of breath or pain or other kinds of symptoms that you're struggling with.
So members of this council would include medical professionals and people who have lived experience with palliative care. Why are these perspectives important to the council's work?
We want to make sure that the recommendations we ultimately make, not only to the Department of Health Services, but certainly to the legislature as well, those recommendations are well-rounded. And we believe that by having different voices at the table, for folks that have some experience with palliative care, whether that's people that have received palliative care or clinicians that have delivered palliative care, we want to make sure that we have a well-rounded set of perspectives as we do our work and make recommendations.
We're talking with Lynn Sexton, board chair of the Wisconsin Hospice and Palliative Care Association, as we discuss the role of palliative care in healthcare in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective along the way at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Lynn, the council would aim to raise awareness and grow the use of palliative care in our state. What are some common misconceptions that you encounter about palliative care?
I would say they boil down to two major ones. One you've already touched on in one of your earlier questions to me, and that is people confusing palliative care with hospice. They are very, very different, as I explained earlier. So that's the number one hurdle that we often have to get over, that people are convinced they're being referred to a hospice provider when the word palliative care comes up. A second is just a general lack of understanding what palliative care is. It's only been a specialty since about 2006, so it's fairly new on the medical scene. And even a fair number of physicians are unfamiliar with what palliative care can do for their patients. So our hope is that one of the main things that this council will do is educate not only the general public, but also the medical community around the advantages of palliative care.
And under this legislation, the Palliative Care Council would consult the State Department of Health Services. How can the State Health Department better support palliative care efforts in Wisconsin?
I mean, one of the most basic ways is to provide information on their website. And I know that sounds so basic, but provide information on their website around what palliative care is and what it is not. Try to dispel some of those myths and how people can access palliative care. It can be difficult in some parts of our state to come across palliative care providers, but hopefully, as we raise awareness of palliative care, we will see more and more palliative care programs pop up across our state.
When you talk about that network, would this new council's work overlap maybe or work in concert with the Palliative Care Network of Wisconsin?
Certainly, in partnership with the Palliative Care Network and with the association that I represent, the Hospice and Palliative Care Association, we want to lock elbows with really any group that provides or is interested in furthering the provision of this type of care in our state. For example, just to give you a sense of the lack of availability. In our state, it can be very difficult to come across palliative care, particularly in rural communities. Palliative care first came on the scene in hospitals. So you might be admitted to the hospital, very, very sick, and your physician, while you were in the hospital, asked a palliative care clinician to come and provide a consult while you were inside the hospital. Today, 52% of the rural hospitals in our state do not provide any type of palliative care. Palliative care is even more helpful when you're discharged from the hospital and there's someone in the community that provides palliative care that can then visit you at your home and continue to make sure that your symptoms are being appropriately palliated. In our state, there's barely a dozen providers that provide palliative care out in the community.
Why do you think those gaps exist?
I think the lack of understanding of what palliative care is, and also, unfortunately, the payment stream for it. It's not a well-reimbursed type of care across our country, not just in the state of Wisconsin. And that is other work that is ongoing to try to improve reimbursement for the service so more providers are willing to adopt palliative care as part of the offering of services that they provide.
Lynn Sexton is with us, board chair of the Wisconsin Hospice and Palliative Care Association, as we discuss policies related to palliative care and improving quality of life for patients with life-threatening illnesses. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We discuss legislation circulating at the Capitol that seeks to raise awareness about palliative care in Wisconsin and help residents receive medical care for their symptoms to improve quality of life when facing life-threatening illnesses. Call in with a question. You can add comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Lynn Sexton is board chair of the Wisconsin Hospice and Palliative Care Association. Lynn, Republican State Representative Patrick Snyder of Schofield is lead author of the bill that would establish the council. And Snyder says that similar legislation he introduced in 2017 failed to pass because of, quote, scare tactics and conspiracies, calling the council a, quote, death panel. Should people be concerned about this council potentially interfering with their medical decisions?
That's a great question. And I very much remember 2017 when this was initially introduced. No, the unfortunate misnomer held by a number of groups is that the work of a palliative care clinician is meant to hasten death, and it couldn't be further from the truth. In fact, palliative care is meant to help someone have a better quality of life as they pursue aggressive curative treatment. So this council very much is on the side of improving life, not hastening the end of it.
Let's bring on a call. Susan in Whitewater is here. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, my 82-year-old mother had a heart attack a month ago, and when we were taking her home, we had to, you know, choose between hospice and palliative care, and at the time, it just really wasn't possible to get palliative care in our area without, I mean, it just would have been so limited compared to what hospice could offer. But there were real downsides to hospice too. I mean, my mother didn't want to really look at things in terms of not having that long to live. And also, you have to give, you can't have therapy. You can't have physical therapy or occupational therapy or anything that might help somebody get better because hospice is intended to, you know, to help you die in many ways. And so, I mean, it's a shame, you know, people's situations are often, they cross categories, and it's a shame that, you know, the programs are set up so you can't really, you know, they don't overlap, I guess.
Susan, thank you for sharing your story. Lynn, what comes up here as you hear Susan's story?
I think she is spot on that it really is a shame how these programs get set up. The federal government, Medicare, is very specific about how hospice can be delivered and who it is for and who it is not for. And then palliative care and its reimbursement structure very much limits the type of resources that an organization can bring into someone's home. Now, I would argue that some amount of intervention by a palliative care clinician is better than no intervention at all. But she is spot on that there is often overlap between these two types of care, and it can be a difficult decision on which way to go for some people.
And then navigating the healthcare coverage, as you said there, the National Institute on Aging says Medicare and Medicaid may cover palliative care and private health insurance might only pay for some services. How would you advise people exploring palliative care in figuring out what services are covered by their health insurance?
Certainly, I would encourage them to call their health insurance provider to understand what benefits that they have. Some insurers will limit their members to only having, you know, three or four visits ever for palliative care. Medicare does not have any limit on the number of visits that a clinician can do, but their reimbursement is extremely low. So it's a series of pluses and minuses when you consider what different insurance programs are willing to cover for palliative care.
And that coverage would then impact how long the palliative care can last, I would imagine.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It does impact it very much so. Yes, which is a shame because study after study after study has demonstrated what palliative care can do to improve quality of life, reduce healthcare spending overall. It reduces trips to the emergency room and hospitalizations. So study after study demonstrates how effective it is all the way around, and yet we still very much struggle with having appropriate reimbursement for this program.
Lynn Sexton is with us, board chair of the Wisconsin Hospice and Palliative Care Association, as we discuss palliative care in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Richard in Two Rivers is here. Hello, Richard.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking my phone call. I'm just going to say quickly that I worked 30 years in physical therapy. And I was licensed in the 5 states, and I worked throughout the country. And in the last 5 years, I worked in over 384 skilled nursing facilities. And I just want to say that hospice care, the importance of it is unmeasurable. Mm. And to politely correct the last caller and Lynn herself, she wasn't quite spot on. I would say the last 2 years, most of my patients were hospice patients, and they were under Medicare, which probably is the majority of the patients. And and I was doing very functional activities, such as if they just needed to get in and out of bed or on and off the commode without assistance into their later stages, or they needed massage and stretching, that's what I did. And so with that being said, I would like to ask a question somewhat unrelated but very important. With the current political situation as it is, and if it goes in one direction as opposed to the other, is there a strong possibility of losing federal and state funding because of the elector?
Richard, thank you for the call. Is there concerns, Lynn, about federal and state funding perhaps going away for palliative care?
I wouldn't say that there's fear of it going away. There's fear that all the work we've been doing to improve funding might stall out. This work has been ongoing, gosh, for 5, 6, 7 years, at least that I've been part of it, to improve funding for palliative care. And in some areas, we're making progress, and in other areas, there's skepticism. And so should there be dramatic changes in the political landscape, that definitely could stall things out.
Julia in Chautauqua called in to ask, who regulates palliative care and what can people do to help move this legislation forward?
So I'll start with the second question and then jump to the first. And I would definitely invite you to shoot off an email to your state senator and let him or her know that you very much support this bill. It's passed the state assembly and it now sits in the state senate for consideration. And we're running into a few obstacles there. So if you are interested at all in helping, send your state senator an email letting them know that you support this bill.
And then in terms of regulation of palliative care.
Yes. So the palliative care is not regulated as highly as other types of health care. Certainly the clinicians that are delivering palliative care have to be appropriately credentialed and licensed. But beyond that, there isn't as much regulation that describes what palliative care may or may not be. There's just a general agreement through various national associations that have to do with palliative care around the types of interventions and approaches that palliative care clinicians do to work alongside the patient's normal physician.
And very quickly, do you think that is a productive setup?
It's a challenging setup, frankly, mm-hmm. because what one state might call palliative care might look very different in the next state, or it could even look different from community to community because it's not specified what kind of falls into the bucket of being palliative care and what does not. So it can cause some confusion.
Lynn, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Happy to.
Lynn Sexton, board chair of the Wisconsin Hospice and Palliative Care Association, president and CEO of Agrace, a hospice provider in southern Wisconsin. And for disclosure, Agrace is a business sponsor of WPR. This is the State Capitol Report. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in with Democratic State Representative Deb Ondraka of Whitefish Bay, a district in Milwaukee's North Shore suburbs. And we get Ondraka's reflections on the recently concluded session in the Assembly and explore her legislative agenda with gun safety measures. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Representative Ondraka, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're advocating for a bill that would ban firearms on university grounds, and current law allows colleges to post notice on buildings to prevent people from entering with guns. Why ban firearms on grounds as well?
Well, we were approached by a group of UW-Madison professors after a number of high-profile shootings on college campuses. And it came to our attention that Wisconsin is really an outlier when it comes to allowing guns on college campuses. So our current law says that universities, public and private, may post building by building that you're not allowed to carry guns into a particular building, but they don't have the same protection that K through 12 schools do that say that this is a gun-free school zone. And in fact, our college campuses have less protection than most of our state buildings that don't allow guns into the buildings. They have less protection than our courthouses. And when you think about college campuses and young people away from home for the first time, I think most of us can agree that that's really not a good place to have firearms around where people can access them.
Why are college campuses more exposed in this area?
They're more exposed because of the way our concealed carry permit law was written back in 2011. So unless a building explicitly says that guns aren't allowed inside, the default is that they are allowed. We reached out and spoke with a number of campus safety offices and asked them about the current state of gun laws on campus. And many of them said it's confusing because if a building is posted no guns, you can't bring firearms into the building. However, if you live off campus, then there's nothing restricting your gun access there. If you're driving a car through campus, what happens then? So what we're trying to do is simply give and extend the same protections to our colleges and universities that our K-12 schools have.
You mentioned Act 35 back in 2011, making it legal for licensed individuals to be armed with a concealed weapon, and how this is potentially on college campuses brought some confusion. What effect has Act 35 had in Wisconsin over now like a dozen years?
Well, we have been living with concealed carry for a while, and I should say that I am a gun owner. I do have my concealed carry permit. So we're not talking about rolling back that law specifically. Mm-hmm. What we are talking about is making sure that when you have young people, and I have two kids who are in college, and when you think back to college days, you realize that it's an emotional time, kids are away from school, and you also have people who are 21 and some who aren't. The thing that we need to think about when we're talking about making campuses more safe from gun violence, too, is that in Wisconsin, two-thirds of our gun deaths are suicides. And so if there is an available firearm, you're not only endangering yourself should you find yourself at risk, but you're also endangering others if people have access to that firearm and it's not secured. Wisconsin does not have any laws requiring that guns are stored safely and away from people who are either underage or who may be at risk. So when you look, look at the whole picture in Wisconsin, it's really a volatile mix, which is why we introduced Assembly Bill 1080 so that we can streamline our gun laws and make sure that we're protecting our college campuses.
The bill would make it a Class A misdemeanor to carry firearms on campus grounds, and violators could face up to 9 months in jail and a $10,000 in fines. Why this level of severity?
It really just brings it in line with some of the other campus, some of the other gun laws that we have in the state. We're not trying to go above and beyond with this particular bill. What we're trying to do is bring a little bit of uniformity. After talking with a number of campus safety officers and police, there is just such a patchwork. So we just think it's time that we make sure that our gun laws have consistency, not only from building to building, but campus to campus and school to school.
You've talked about wanting college campuses to become as secure as K-12 schools. Why do you think is the same level of security needed at colleges for adults and K-12 schools for kids?
Well, you're talking about firearms. You're talking about whether or not people can access them. And we just want to make sure that when you're either at school or when you're at college, when the professors came to us, they realized that with more people, with more guns in more places, there is a greater risk right now with people either coming into your classroom or coming out. And arguments today seem to escalate very quickly. And we want to make sure that if they do, that there are no firearms involved. So making sure that our college campuses are safe, like our K-12 schools are, just seems to make sense.
We're talking about a bill that would ban firearms on college campuses with Deb Andraka, bill author and Democratic state representative from Whitefish Bay. Colin, with a question, you can share your comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So why introduce the bill near the end of the legislative session for scheduled floor votes? What about the timing here?
The timing is about how much care we put into crafting this legislation. We know there's an awful lot of controversy out there whenever you introduce a new gun law. It tends to be politically polarizing. And so when we were approached by the group of professors, we went out and we met with campus safety officers and called campus safety officers in different parts of the state, because we realized that in urban areas with campuses, rural areas with campuses, suburban areas with campuses, there are different needs, there are different laws. And so we wanted to make sure that we were bringing all the stakeholders to the table and putting out a bill that wasn't just sort of a knee-jerk reaction to a problem. So we put a lot of thought into it. We made sure that we included law enforcement in the decisions, professors and students, and so that we could introduce something that was also in line with our existing gun laws and existing campus laws. So when we reached out to law enforcement, there was a 2017 poll, was one of the most recent ones we could find. 71% of respondents opposed allowing concealed weapons on university campuses. In 2021, there was a survey that said that support for carrying concealed weapons on campuses fell to only 27%. So we wanted to make sure we had something that was in line with public sentiment, made our law enforcement professionals' job easier, not more difficult, and was something that was consistent all across the state and that they could live with.
State Assembly leaders, as you know, are planning no additional floor votes for this session. Are you asking Governor Tony Evers to call a special session on the legislation?
Well, we've tried that. Back in, I think, 2018, we had a special session trying to get some other gun laws passed, just making sure that we have background checks on every gun sale and we have a red flag law and the Republicans gaveled in and gaveled out that session. So I don't see the current legislature being able to take action on this bill. If the governor were to call a special session, we'd probably see the same results. However, as we all know, we have new legislative maps. And so hopefully in the next legislative session, we can take an idea like this and start to move it forward with people who are elected and are more responsive to the people who put them in office.
As you mentioned there, this month, Governor Evers signed into law new legislative voting maps. And we talked with John Johnson at Marquette University Law School about how these maps offer Democrats their first shot at majorities in years. But you voted against the maps. Can you tell us why?
Sure. Well, when the maps came over to us in the assembly, we had about 30 minutes to look at them. It was a very long bill. And I strongly believe that any bill needs a public hearing, and particularly when it comes to legislative voting maps. So there was a line in the bill when the assembly got it that we were unclear about, which was about special elections and the timing of when the maps would go into place. And we didn't have enough time to get satisfactory answers from the Legislative Reference Bureau and others. And so I voted no, not because I don't want new maps, because I certainly was very enthusiastic about getting some new, more fair maps. But that's just not the way I think government should be run. I mean, we should be able to hear from the public. We should make sure that we're holding hearings and being thoughtful. So I voted no because of the timing and just the fact that we had so little time to look through a complex bill. And if you go back and look at the bill, you can see it's a whole bunch of zip codes and everything else together. So why don't you make sure my vote was thoughtful? So my no vote was more about only having a very small amount of time to look at the proposal and a big question about a line that was added at the very, very end of the bill, not because I didn't like the maps, because I'm very excited that we're finally going to be getting fair maps in Wisconsin.
How do Democrats, your caucus, feel about these maps?
Well, we are very excited because we can finally run campaigns where we have competitive districts. And fair maps is not about making sure there's a majority in one party or another. So if we were guaranteed a Democratic majority, then it would just be another gerrymander. But we are very excited to run candidates in districts all across the state that could be the candidate could be elected from either party. So in 2020, I was one of the very few candidates, there's only three of us in a decade, that flipped a district from Republican to Democrat. And now we finally have a chance, instead of having three seats in a decade, we have probably 20 seats across the state. That's exciting. We should have candidates that are being elected on their message, not their maps. And so for the first time, we might have a legislature that looks like the voting public. So that is an opportunity for lots of bills, like gun safety bills. We know that gun safety bills poll at 60, 70, 80% popularity, but we've never been able to get a public hearing because we've been so polarized. So if we can finally get a more balanced legislature, I'm very optimistic that next session we can have public hearings on bills like the campus firearm safety bill and finally start to make some progress to bring down the rate of gun violence in the state.
We discussed policy priorities with Democratic State Representative Deb Ondraka of Whitefish Bay. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective. 800-642-1234. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Democratic State Representative Deb Ondraka of Whitefish Bay, a member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. Be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Representative, as you you sit on the legislature's Joint Finance Committee that oversees state spending, we saw on Friday Governor Tony Evers vetoing three bills in a $2 billion tax cut package. And Republicans had split the package into several bills in hopes they wouldn't all be vetoed. What are your thoughts on this tax cut package?
Well, the Republicans' tax cut package, when you took it in its entirety, would take our current state budget surplus into a deficit in just a few short years. And when we're looking at what we need, what our state's priorities are, what I hear from my constituents is that there are a lot of places that the state needs to invest after a decade of budgets that were designed to cover the bare minimum. I also sit in the education committee. Our public schools have been underfunded for more than a decade. We have infrastructure projects. We have lead pipes. There are our parks are vastly underfunded. We are 50 out of 50th in state spending on Wisconsin's state parks. So I am 100% for returning the surplus to taxpayers, but we also have to make sure that we are making investments in the parts of Wisconsin that make it great and that attract workers and young people to our state. And so we have a once in a lifetime opportunity to do that with the state surplus. We need to remember this is not a structural surplus. This is not money that is coming in to over and over year over year. What we have is some leftover spending and some leftover money from the pandemic, and we're still living through that. So yes, we absolutely do want to return some of the surplus, but we also need to look at some of the areas of the state that have been neglected. And I don't want to vote for any proposal that would put us back into deficit spending in just a few years.
So it sounds as if you're saying there are myriad other issues that Wisconsin is grappling with that this surplus could help. And yet I also hear you say that you would support a tax cut package. How can you do both?
Well, you can do both by scaling down the tax cuts that the Republicans have proposed. I'm very much in favor of the tax cut that the Republicans proposed for childcare. Now, I would have preferred us to invest in childcare counts, which was a program that we heard from over and over again that childcare providers need in order to keep their centers open. Anyone who's tried to put an infant in childcare knows that it costs more than in-state tuition right now for infant care. And it's not sustainable. And at a time when we have a labor shortage, we really need to get as many people into the workforce as possible. And really, parents, they need this kind of help. So I would have liked to have seen the state invest in childcare counts. The Republicans proposed a more modest tax cut for childcare expenses. So, that is an area of compromise that I hope that we will see going forward. The other parts of the Republican tax cut package, a lot of that was skewed towards more wealthy folks in the state. And I would like to see that go toward people who are struggling a lot more. So we had questions. I think we will reach a compromise, and I think that going forward, we just need to be a little bit more balanced in what we're doing with the surplus. Yes, we can return some money to taxpayers, but we also need to make sure that we're not underfunding areas of the state like childcare and parks and education.
You mentioned the child tax credits. Governor Evers hasn't signed or vetoed that fourth bill from the package that would expand child tax credits. What are your hopes there for the future of that bill?
I do hope that the governor signs that. I think that is something that, like I said, it's not the program that we would have liked to have seen. We would have liked to have seen child care counts, as would most child care providers in the states and the families who depend on them. But I do think that is a compromise that should be reached with Republicans. So at least it's a step in the right direction. If we're going in that direction, perhaps next session we can, with a different legislature, we can make some more bold moves towards ensuring that our childcare industry is sustainable, and we can open some more centers and slots for families who are on long, long waiting lists and who need it. But in the meantime, that is something that I would like to see the governor sign into law.
We're talking about policy priorities with Deb Andraka, Democratic State Representative from Whitefish Bay. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. In January, the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau estimated the state's operating budget would have a surplus of $3.25 billion by the end of the current budget cycle. What do you think should lawmakers do with that money then?
Well, personally, I would like to see us invest in education. We are spending on public education in our public schools has not kept up with inflation. And for so long, we have seen our public schools doing more with less. A specific area would be special education. The state only reimbursed 33% of the special education costs for public schools, and they are required by law to provide a free and appropriate public education to every student, regardless of their disability. And that is something that we need to do, but it's something that we also need to fund. And we have not been doing that. And so that's an area I would like to see us improve on. I have two kids in college, and I have seen our public schools over the years just struggling to keep up not only with inflation, but with the growing needs of today's students. We can't prepare students for the jobs of tomorrow when we are not funding them adequately. So I really want to see public education get the funding and the reliable, sustainable support that it deserves.
What are your priorities for the Joint Finance Committee this spring?
Well, we are coming to the end of the legislative session. Mm-hmm. And so we were not, the Senate, I think, is still going in. The Assembly is basically wrapping up its floor session. There'll be a couple more, a week or two. I think there's a week in March and a week in April where there's sort of cleanup business, but all of our bills passing are pretty much done. If we can't come to agreement on what to do with the surplus in this session, then we will come to a decision next session. And in the meantime, the surplus will grow in interest. And so it's not the worst problem in the world to have. We do need to return money to taxpayers. But as far as what we do over the next couple of months, one thing I would like for us to make sure that we do is to take a look at what we're doing with the surplus and maybe just talk to each other over the next couple of months and making sure that we're getting along a little bit better.
You mean lawmakers talking with each other? How has communication been this session?
Not great. So this is only my second term in office. I was I was elected in 2020. Mm-hmm. And it is so rare to flip a district from Republican to Democratic. I can say that I was not exactly welcomed with open arms by some of my Republican colleagues. I would like to see more bipartisanship. I would like to see us be able to compromise a little bit more. And I would really, really like to see us come together on issues that have very, very strong public support. Mm-hmm. Things like gun safety, things like Badger Care expansion, things like environmental quality and parks. It would be great for us to really be able to sit down and hammer out some more bold proposals that we can all agree on, and not just agree on as legislators, but that the public agrees on.
Representative Andraka, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Deb Andraka, Democratic State Representative in Whitefish Bay, on the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine potential solutions to urgent economic problems that might be applied in Wisconsin and elsewhere. These initiatives underway in different parts of the world, they aim to help close the wealth gap, they aim to address the climate crisis, and create meaningful jobs along the way. You can be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question, share your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Romeo covers policy and ideas for The New Yorker, teaches in the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. His book is called The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy. Nick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you write about how economists and leaders take the structure of the economy as set in stone. But you argue that it can be organized in many ways. Why has thinking about the economy become so rigid?
Sure. You know, the first chapter of the book, I get into some of that history, and I also get into some of the really battles that are raging in the present over how to teach economics to undergraduates, to graduate students. But a short answer has to do with the kind of false analogy of economics to physics, where there are supposedly natural laws that govern the economy and that are unalterable. It turns out that a lot of times when people think in this way, those natural laws are very, very beneficial to the status quo and they prevent meaningful change. So that's a kind of target of critique for people trying to reform economics education, is to get rid of that way of thinking and to have a more kind of nuanced and empirical approach. Because if you just look at how economies have changed, you'll quickly see that many of these so-called laws are nothing of the sort.
Hmm. You have also said that economists thinking themselves as scientists is undemocratic. Can you go into that a little bit?
Well, you know, in this first chapter, I'm really quoting many economists themselves. The scientist label is an interesting one. It seems like people in the field are a little bit split on that. Some will say social scientist, so there's that modifier there before scientist. Others will just reject the term entirely, and there are still a few who cling to it as well. I think the connection to democracy is that, you know, if your view is that economists have a kind of very particular access to knowledge about how we should set up our economy and that they alone have that, it's a little bit hard to see why ordinary people should have much input, right? So there is some tension between seeing economists as the kind of reigning high priests who should have total control because of their scientific knowledge and seeing sort of these decisions being made in a much more democratic way where everyone should have some input over how we're doing, you know, everything from wages to the structure of labor markets, to decisions about distribution, taxation, and very consequential decisions about climate policy.
Hmm. You also reach far back to philosophers and novelists like Plato and Tolstoy. Why look to them for economic insights instead of like the economists of today?
Well, you know, many of the economists today are sort of rediscovering points that were originally made in the works of novelists and philosophers. So some of the more educated economists realize that, which is great. You know, I quote Sam Bowles, for instance, who's a wonderful economist. At the end of his book on game theory, he acknowledges that much of what he's been saying is kind of a rediscovery of Aristotle. Hmm. So, yeah, you know, I think Plato, Tolstoy, a lot of these thinkers have very deep insights into questions that are economic, that have to do with how resources are distributed, but also how they should be distributed. And notice there's a kind of dual purpose there to their inquiry. They want to know how things do work, but they also ask the question of how they should work.
Hmm. Yes. Talking about the economy with Nick Romeo, author of The Alternative, you can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. You introduce us to true pricing and you explore what people pay for products and the true price paid for making those items. What do you mean by the true price?
Yeah, true pricing is quite interesting. It's a movement that has really taken off in the Netherlands, although there's interest around Europe, and there are also some American think tanks and institutions that use the methodology. So basically, an easy way to think of it is that, you know, currently when we go into a grocery store, we pick up a product, we have a patchwork of different labels, each of which gives us some visibility into the conditions along that supply chain. So for instance, if you buy something that's organic, let's take the classic example of an apple, you get your organic apple. You know, the word organic, it does have some legally enforceable meaning. So you do know certain things because of that label. So then let's say your apple is also local. Okay, that maybe there's a bit of wiggle room there, but you at least know that it wasn't flowing halfway around the world. And so you have some insight into, let's say, the carbon footprint. You still might not know anything about the working conditions of the people who grew and picked and transported your apple. Even with labels like Fair Trade, which do cover some of those labor conditions, it's very partial and you don't have a lot of visibility. So a true price, it takes all of these different elements and it says, what if we could actually combine all of these and put the information in those into the price signal itself? So economics refers to the cost of transactions that are not included in a price as externalities. So mm-hmm. This could be an impact on the environment. But it could be the fact that maybe the community in which wages are very low starts to have all sorts of problems. It could be a kind of human rights issue as well.
So this grocery store in Amsterdam attempts to account for these types of costs and offers shoppers the choice of whether to pay them or not. Can you talk about what happened in the grocery store and what impact it's had on shoppers?
Well, surprisingly, at least to the owner, the business in the store improved after they rolled out true pricing for products. That, you know, at first people were confused and they wanted to understand why they were paying more. But once they understood that the previous cheapness of prices was kind of an illusion and that by not paying them, it's not that those prices went away, it's just that other people paid them, often people who were quite vulnerable far away. So people were happy to pay those higher prices, at least in this store in Amsterdam. And then some of that extra money generated by the true price surplus is used to help remediate some of those issues that I described, whether those are environmental or kind of labor and human impacts.
But I think you also said it's difficult to be able to trace that money back to the source of where where those disparities are occurring. Is that a downfall of true pricing?
It's a challenge for sure. Yeah, it's currently not highly precise in the targeting. So, you know, you may not know exactly which chocolate came from which farm. And so if you generate a surplus through true pricing, it can be hard to know exactly how to trace that money back to the growers and producers. But that's really only speaking from the vantage point of this one grocery store. If you think from a broader perspective, companies can use true pricing as well. And I talk about a European chocolate company that uses true pricing to audit its own supply chains. And so they know exactly where these disparities are within their supply chain and can remediate it very precisely. Governments and policymakers can also use true pricing as a tool, and they can have some of that more fine-grained information often.
Hmm. Journalist and author Nick Romeo with us, new book that gives this roadmap for a sustainable and just economy with solutions to address wealth inequality and the climate crisis. Call in with a question, add comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new book asks the question, what unrealized ideas could help the greater world survive and flourish in these times? And we wonder what economic initiatives could Wisconsin replicate from other parts of the world that could create a sustainable future? Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Romeo's new book is called The Alternative. Nick, let's turn to minimum wage. When policymakers or economists refer to living wages, they generally mean the minimum amount of money that someone needs to cover the cost costs of living. You found that actually calculating a living wage is complicated and subjective. Why is it so difficult?
You know, this was a really interesting chapter for me to research and report. The term living wage first really takes off in America just over 100 years ago. And figures like Teddy Roosevelt had a very generous, capacious understanding of what living meant, at least relative to how it's often understood today. So things like savings for retirement, money for childcare, a little bit of money for a rainy day, an unexpected life event, even a short vacation. All of this was part of Roosevelt's understanding of living. Now, fast forward to today, and those elements have been stripped away. We have a much, much less generous conception of living. And so whenever someone talks about a living wage, I think the first thing to do is to get very clear on which elements they're including and which they're excluding. And this is, as you can probably imagine, not something that economists alone should answer. It's really a more political, ethical, and democratic discussion to be had.
And you introduce us to the MIT living wage calculator. Can you explain what that calculator is doing with trying to create living or trying to basically figure out what a living wage means in different parts of the country?
Yeah, so the MIT living wage calculator has lots and lots of data on the county and state levels about different elements of the costs of living. So things like groceries, rent, et cetera, all around the country. So in one sense, it's very useful, and it has been used by both employees and employers to figure out, you know, in my neck of the woods, the Bay Area versus your neck of the woods, what does it actually cost to live? What if you have one kid? What if you have two kids? What if you have one family? What if you have two? You can input all of this into the calculator and it spits out an answer. The way in which it's less helpful is that some of the definition of living that it uses is kind of buried within the technical documentation for the calculator. And if you dig into it a little bit, it turns out that all of those Roosevelt elements that I mentioned have really been stripped away. And so it's a very constricted sense of living. The economist at MIT who runs that calculator told me that she regularly gets emails from people all around the country saying, I can't live on what you're calling a living wage. So in some sense, it's a deeply misleading term. And in, you know, many people feel like I'm not actually living. I'm just sort of barely not dying.
And yet companies use this calculator to inform what they will pay their workers.
That's right. It's very widely used. It's very influential, both in policy circles and in the for-profit sector. So I think it's desperately in need of a dramatic overhaul. And I think a much more generous conception of living would really enable that term to be accurately understood. So that if you say, I earn a living wage, I think most people think, oh, you know, that's kind of a decent middle-class lifestyle. Maybe you get to go out to a restaurant sometimes, you take a little vacation. Turns out that's very far from true.
Opponents of raising the minimum wage say businesses would lay off workers and inflation would grow. That would hurt low-income, low-wage workers the most. What do researchers know about minimum wage hikes?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, in the last few decades, the consensus has changed. Two economists won a Nobel Prize for a famous paper and actually a whole body of research comparing areas in which the minimum wage was raised to areas in which it was not. So they found these kind of natural experiments in which you could look at two otherwise similar regions in which only one of the two regions had raised the minimum wage. And the orthodoxy, the kind of expectation was that, oh yeah, of course, if you raise minimum wages, there are going to be huge, huge impacts on unemployment. Because just as you said, businesses will have to close. So it turns out those effects have been dramatically overstated. That's often simply not the case. Now, to be fair, if you think about raising to living wages and to a sort of generous definition of living, there could very well be effects on unemployment. And, you know, the Catholic priest in the early 20th century who defined the term in America and wrote a book about it, I like his thinking on this matter because he kind of redefines what we even mean by a successful business. And he says sort of that a successful business is one that can pay its workers well. That's kind of just part of the cost of doing business. You don't succeed by paying your workers so that they can live very limited, miserable, marginal lives where they're constantly struggling. That's just a misunderstanding of the term mm-hmm. success. So I think there's a cultural piece here too that would need to shift.
We discussed the economy with Nick Romeo, who covers policy and ideas at The New Yorker, teaches at the University of California, Berkeley. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Nick, in November, the president of the Wisconsin State Senate appeared on our program and opposed raising the minimum wage. Here's Republican State Senator Chris Kapinga.
We've got people, entry-level college kids, who we come in and do internships at my business, and you know, we offered $15 an hour, and they tell me I can go to Quick Trip and work part-time for $17 an hour. So the reality is the minimum wage, there's not a job out there that's paying that low right now.
Wisconsin having the federal minimum wage. Are market forces making it unnecessary for elected officials to raise the minimum wage?
No, I don't think that's the case. You know, it's easy to sort of cherry pick one or two examples, but if you look at the struggles of people all around the country, there are so many folks who are struggling to afford housing, food, childcare. All of these costs have increased in the last few years. And so I think it's misleading to suggest that market forces are kind of naturally taking care of folks. There's just far too much struggle among low-wage workers for that to be the case.
You talked to the owner of Well-Paid Maids, this D.C.-based company that pays workers a starting salary that is double the median wage of maids. What does this example illustrate?
Yeah, so this is a fascinating business. It was started by a millennial in D.C., a guy named Aaron Sayedian, and he launched the business explicitly as an intervention into debates about wage setting. You know, he wanted to show that you could be a successful business while still paying people decently. And he has really succeeded in that goal. He has grown year on year enormously, is expanding to other cities along the East Coast. He pays well above even the MIT definition, which is, as we talked about, pretty minimal. So his sense of a living wage is very capacious. He promotes from within, so you'll have people who started as cleaners who move up to operations managers. And, you know, at that point, they could be making $60,000, $70,000. So it's a nice kind of proof of concept for businesses succeeding while paying workers quite well.
Let's bring on Bill in Wausau now. Bill, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for the program. I'm enjoying it. My question is there anybody calculating how much of the cost of a particular product goes to CEOs, to corporate costs, to shareholders, compared to how much of each product's cost is allocated to workers, producers, salespeople, transport, and things like that? I think that would be a useful breakdown to help us make consumer decisions and political decisions.
Bill, thank you. Nick, go ahead.
Bill, I totally agree with you. I think that's a really good suggestion. My understanding is that the folks at True Price, they do sometimes use the tool in a customizable way. So it would really just be tweaking some of the parameters. If you could get that information through, you know, SEC filings or the European equivalent of those kinds of filings for publicly traded companies, you could say, look, here's the pay ratio of highest to lowest paid worker. We're going to factor that into the true price. What if that ratio were cut in half? How would that change? I think that's a wonderful idea.
We have journalist and author Nick Romeo's new book. It's called The Alternative, exploring some of the world's unique economic and policy ideas and what we could learn from them in Wisconsin and elsewhere. You can be part of the discussion. Email ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new book argues that a combination of public and private sector initiatives can improve the world by creating a more just economy. We explore examples across the globe that seek to help develop fair and sustainable economies and what frameworks that Wisconsin might consider. You can be part of the conversation, call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Nick Romeo's book is called The Alternative. Let's go to Daryl in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Well, I'd like to bring up my interpretation of the way the economy is not balanced toward the worker these days. 30, 40 years ago, we had companies where the husband could go to work and earn enough money and the wife could stay home. Not to say that that's what would work in this modern economy with women's rights, which they should be entitled to be paid well as men. But the fact, I think, is that they're just more of the profits of the companies are going to the CEOs and the owners of companies, which I think is fair, but I think that more of that money could be transitioned to the workers' wages, where they could live in a more sustainable economy and pay bills without struggling.
Daryl,
I think there should be more of a balance there.
Daryl, thank you for bringing up that balance. Nick, what are the ratios did you encounter between CEOs and rank-and-file workers?
You know, the latest data in America is pretty extraordinary. It's around 350, so that's 350 to 1. This is really an anomalous figure if you zoom out. And by zoom out, I mean both look around the world, but also look back in time, even in America. So one of the chapters in the book focuses on a network of worker-owned cooperatives in northern Spain. All of these businesses, and some of them do enormous industrial manufacturing of things like jet engines and elevators, all of these businesses have a pay ratio cap of 6 to 1. Hmm. So that, you know, is just an extraordinary difference, 6 to 1 versus 350 to 1. Now, the kind of standard prediction would be if you pay executives so little, you're not going to be able to recruit top talent, and so your business will suffer and eventually disappear. On the contrary, the Mondragon cooperatives in Spain are enormously successful. They compete for contracts around the globe. They have over 80,000 workers. So it's a really robust model that, at least for that part of Spain, has had tremendous success. And I can talk about other examples in the States and elsewhere where that ratio is more compressed, if that would be useful.
And it was so interesting, though, with Mondragon that, you know, like the people in the cooperatives, they voted democratically on the ratio between the highest and lowest worker in terms of pay. I mean, it's so interesting to see the difference between, you know, the corporate world here and what is happening, what you are able to write about, what's happening in Mondragon Corporation.
Absolutely. And, you know, that brings us back to this question of democracy again. If you give people a vote on the question of executive compensation, it turns out that current ratios are not very popular. There's some interesting international research that I dig into a little bit in that chapter, where researchers interviewed people in countries around the world, and they asked two questions. The first question is, what do you think executive to worker pay is? The second question, what do you think it should be? Now, there was some variation between countries, but a general consensus emerged, and there was a pattern to how people answered both of those questions. So on the first question, people tended to think that ratios were much, much lower than in fact they are. So they would say, you know, I would guess it's 30 to 1, when in fact it might be 300 to 1 in a particular country. So they think that the world is less unequal than it actually is. Move on to that second question. What do you think it should be? People's answers compressed even further. Around the world, there was variation, but a typical answer was right around 7 to 1. So Mondragon is actually a place where what people think should exist more or less does.
Allison in Racine called in to ask if you had researched the impact of unions and the ability to increase living wages for their members.
Yes, unions, I think, are a vital tool. I do talk about unions in my living wage chapter, and I think, you know, collective bargaining throughout American history has been very important. The legal landscape has become much more challenging. There have been many laws that make it harder to unionize, where you have to unionize each workplace. So, you know, that's an unfortunate development, and that hurts workers' wages. But absolutely, unions are a vital part of making wages truly livable.
You also explore this idea of guaranteed jobs, and the state of Lower Austria created this pilot program that gave a job to anyone who had been unemployed for a year. What effects did this have?
So the job guarantee in Austria is a really interesting experiment. It's a kind of policy intervention where instead of just spending money on unemployment, the employment service over there said, what if we gave people work? Now, only people who want to work have to. It's important to distinguish this from something like workfare, where you're compelled back into the private labor market. So you're given the option to remain on unemployment, but if you'd prefer to go and work at a job, you can do that. And the types of jobs are a co-creation of the person looking for jobs and a social worker who understands some of the needs in the community. So they're co-designed such that people find them interesting and meaningful, but they also are intended to fulfill some sort of need that the community has. What was interesting, I mean, one thing I found really interesting is that everyone who was given the option to join the job guarantee wanted to. You might think people would say, oh no, I'll just keep receiving unemployment. I don't want to work. Why would I choose to work when I could do nothing and just receive the money? On the contrary, everyone wanted to participate. And I think the fact that they could co-design their jobs was a big part of that. But another part of it was that, you know, work really does provide people with more than just money. It gives you colleagues and a social network. It can have positive impacts on your self-esteem. It can give you a way to structure your time every day. So all of these kind of psychological and social benefits are also being studied by some of the economists and sociologists who are watching this experiment in Austria.
And it's fascinating. You found that it's no more costly than what the state already spends on its unemployment program. Is that right?
That is right. Yeah, that was an important design feature of the job guarantee. And you can kind of see how that would preempt the objection that, oh, we can't afford this. It's too much money. On the contrary, they're spending that money anyway. So why not do something that has some of these social and psychological benefits for the people participating, but that also can meet some needs in the community?
We're talking with Nick Romeo, author of The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy. Call in with your questions or thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. Nick, what do researchers think would happen if the United States government created a national job guarantee program? What might happen here?
So there's an economist that I cite in this chapter who has done some modeling of that, and it's actually surprisingly feasible and affordable. It's also quite popular in polling with Americans to have a federal job guarantee. You know, I think a few things could happen if that were instituted in the states at a federal level. And, you know, to a lesser extent, I think this could also happen at a state level, which might be more realistic given the political environment here. But one of the things that would happen would be upward pressure on private sector employers. If every worker in America knew that they had a solid option for the public sector job guarantee, private sector employers would have to compete more. They'd have to compete on the quality of their work, the meaning, the conditions, but also on the quantity of wages. So that pressure would improve private sector conditions too. You simply couldn't get away with some of the behaviors that a lot of the low road employers in America currently do. You know, I think another thing that could happen with a federal job guarantee is that you could mobilize an enormous number of people to tackle really essential societal needs, whether that's care work for young and old people in America, which the private market currently fails pretty atrociously in those areas, or whether that's sort of infrastructure refurbishing, green transition work. There's no shortage of work that needs doing and that the private sector is either not doing or doing too slowly. So I think it could have a lot of wide-ranging effects.
How might a program like this affect the gig economy and the marketplace of part-time work?
Well, a job guarantee would be an interesting candidate for gig economy to interface with, because I mean, I think one thing that would have to be sort of worked out with a job guarantee is the question of part-time or flexible work. Like if you only have 20 hours a week, maybe because you're caring for young people, maybe because you have a medical condition and that's sort of your upper limit, how can a job guarantee accommodate you? Now, I know from the Austria example that flexibility is kind of built into their design. So there are people there who are working 15 hours, there are people who are working closer to 40 hours. So if you had that sort of flexibility, it's still maybe a question of whether you could use a job guarantee to start to compete with services like Lyft, Uber, DoorDash. I have a separate chapter in the book that actually pretty explicitly would be a public sector option for gig work. But I think a job guarantee could at least be one way of helping to put some pressure on those companies just by giving people another option.
Nick Romeo covers policy and ideas at The New Yorker. The book is called The Alternative, examining different visions for how to build an equitable economy. Call in with a question. Bring your thoughts to the discussion at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with journalist Nick Romeo about how governments across the globe are implementing creative and practical solutions to urgent economic problems and making progress on closing inequalities. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. The book is called The Alternative. Nick, you write about a movement involving the Democracy Collaborative and private equity funds to buy up companies and turn them into worker-owned cooperatives. How does this process work?
So the basic idea is that there are lots of businesses around America, many of them owned by baby boomers, but not all, that are going to transition within the next decade. What if each of those businesses were converted into a worker-owned co-op? So instead of selling a business to private equity or a strategic buyer, these funds, they accumulate institutional capital. Then they take that capital to offer competitive sale prices to retiring business owners. So the business owner still gets some benefit. Then the fund owns the business, converts it into a worker ownership model. And then over time, workers sort of gain equity. So they pay back the fund. The fund gets some return on investment. So it's this kind of triple win, if you will. The workers benefit, the capital owners, the investment people, they get some money, and then the retiring business owner also gets a nice retirement. All of it's in the service of decreasing wealth inequality. Worker ownership models compress some of those pay ratios that we were talking about earlier.
How significant is the current model, the current dominance of private equity in buyouts and owners exiting their companies?
Well, it's important to stress that this model that I'm describing is not the default mode of operation for private equity. So I think in the last year, this actually might be for 2022, there was something like 4,000 private equity deals, and there were only 400 ESOPs created. ESOP stands for Employee Stock Ownership Plan. So that's, as the name suggests, a shared ownership model. That ratio, these are ballpark figures, but the 10 to 1 ratio there of 4,000 to 400 gives you a sense of the scale. And it shows that worker ownership is still not as widespread or mainstream as perhaps it should be.
So if a larger portion of American companies were worker owned, what effects would this have on the economy at large?
Well, one statistic that I really have been struck by in the book is, if you imagine the level of worker ownership at Sears department stores in the 1950s in America, and then you apply that same level of worker ownership to Amazon workers in 2018, every Amazon worker would have roughly $380,000 of equity. Now, that's from 2018. Amazon stock has more than doubled since then. So we'd be talking about closer to $1 million of equity. And this would be for people who deliver packages, stock shelves at warehouses, and this is just for Amazon. Now, imagine that model spreading to 100 largest employers in America. I think you can see that pretty quickly you'd get to a robust and flourishing middle class. So worker ownership, it's hard to overstate the potential it has to combat wealth inequality in the country.
Let's bring in Marty in Elkhorn now. Marty, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. You know, if you were to take a spectrum, your guest's suggestion would be on one end about, I guess, in essence, making the worker, eventually the workers own the company. At the other end would be the trickle-down effect. And I believe that is a big cause of why workers are so ill-paid, because any profit that comes goes to the shareholders first. And then what's left over trickles down to the employees. And you know the shareholders are going to want a return on their investment. You know, the workers are always going to get short shrift. So that's my comment.
Marty,
thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, Marty, thank you. Nick, what do you make of that sentiment?
I largely agree. I mean, I think that shareholders and maybe especially some of their more aggressive representatives, they are very influential in pressuring companies to cost cut, which when it comes to wages for workers means depriving workers of income. And, you know, I think it's also reasonable to wonder about whether publicly traded companies are going to be open to using these kinds of shared ownership models. There are some examples of ESOPs at publicly traded companies. They're not super common, but the two structures are compatible. So I think there's hope there, but it's true that shareholders are not necessarily going to want some of the profits that they could be getting to go to workers. Now, on the other hand, there's an argument that workers work harder when they have some ownership stake in a company. As they say in business school, the incentives are aligned. So you feel like you own the company, you're going to work harder. So there is a conceivable win-win there, but I think it's also the case that sometimes it is more of a zero-sum dynamic where one loss is the other's gain.
I was thinking about here in Wisconsin how we have hundreds of co-ops, over 700 co-ops, according to the UW Center for Cooperatives. 240 of them are in the agriculture sector. What effect might farmer-led co-ops have on the broader Wisconsin economy? Any insights there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there are, people mean different things by co-ops, you know, so there are producer co-ops, consumer co-ops. When you have those statistics, do you know which type those apply to?
They were looking at all different sectors of the economy. 240 of them were in the agriculture sector. I mean, here we have like dairy co-ops. And I'm just wondering, when you talk about ESOPs, are they in the same category as what we might think here of co-ops, like in the dairy industry?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's at least a strong family resemblance. So worker-owned cooperatives are typically modeled on a kind of democratic one worker, one vote structure where the people at the workplace have some direct input over really important decision making. I mean, sometimes this is called open book management, mm-hmm. but you typically do see effects on wages and profit sharing when you give people voting power over how the business is run. So if the co-ops in Wisconsin follow these models where every worker is given input over wage setting, then I think there's absolutely a strong kind of shared ownership structure that's likely to result from that.
In our last moments together, is there one idea that you think could immediately make our economy more equitable?
Probably the worker ownership model that we've been describing. I think that's a kind of, I don't want to say quick fix, but it would have an immediate impact. If you have enormous amounts of value and profit that companies are generating, simply sharing more of that with the workers who help to create that profit and value, that immediately sort of pushes income and wealth back down the economic scale, compresses pay gaps, and also really diminishes people's sense of just unfairness and kind of anger over the current economy in which they work. So I think that if I had to choose one, that would probably be it.
Nick, thank you for joining us and for sharing your book with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nick Romeo covers policy and ideas at The New Yorker, and his book is called The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.